From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz, the Dean of the Graduate School of Education, and Denise Pope, Senior Lecturer here at the Graduate School of Education. Hi, Dan.
Hello, Denise. So today we're going to talk about how much learning is social, and like small group work, and you're at school, or maybe you're on the job and you're doing group work. So I want to start out by a little question for you.
Okay. This is Stump Denise. You love doing this.
I do enjoy doing this. And this one's unfair because it's one of those ones you're going to have to run through your mind and try and think of every possibility.
Oh, great.
And so the question is sort of how much of learning in school is social? So there are things that aren't social, like your eyes learn to focus as an infant. So that's probably not social. But you're in school. Sort of how much of the topics, the content, so forth. Can you think of any example that's not social?
Okay, let me think of this. So, I mean, there are certain things that are clearly social, like lunchtime or recess. But do you mean in the classroom itself?
Sure.
Okay, so in the classroom itself, anything not social? Well, if you are given a worksheet and you're told to do it completely by yourself in silence, is that social?
So I would say yes, because that worksheet was designed by a person. In fact, almost all the content that you're learning is social. The textbooks, somebody wrote them, they had a point of view.
So this was basically a trick question.
Yes.
And the answer is 100% of the time is social.
I think so. Now, there are situations where it's social in the sense that you're interacting with each other.
Yes.
And that's what we're talking about today.
Okay, so when you interact with another human being, not a worksheet or a textbook— not the teacher. Is it when you interact with your peers?
I think interacting with your teacher is social. Even if your teacher doesn't seem like a person, they seem mean and
like a
evil.
Robot.
Yeah.
You know that wah wah. You know that.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
okay, but for group work, right? Then we are saying you're interacting with at least one other student or peer.
Yeah, that's what we're going to talk about today.
Okay, cool.
And so it's pretty amazing. You know, the literature on this over and over and over, it shows that cooperative learning where you're working together to try and solve problems always leads to better outcomes than working by yourself.
So I have kids at home who may contradict that. And I will tell you why.
Yes.
So they, a lot of kids I know, not just my kids, may roll their eyes a little bit when it comes to group work because invariably there seems to be someone who ends up doing a ton of the work and someone who they would call a slacker, not doing all the work. So they would say, oh, this group project, it's so unfair. I'm doing all the work and Johnny hasn't done anything. And, you know, it's bad.
So I have to say, you know, when I did group work, my response was, the reason I didn't like it was different. It was, no, they should all be doing my ideas and what I said.
Right. So if you're bossy,
yes,
right, it's really, it's a problem if you're doing group work.
And it's worse because they should be doing my ideas and they should be doing all the work.
Right. Exactly. You're the slacker and the bossy.
That's right.
I could totally see that. So the other thing that I would say is there are some kids who love group work because it's time to be social and they want to be with their friends. And they also, it's hands-on. It's not the teacher lecturing. It's not doing work. It's different. It's novel.
Yeah.
Right? So some kids love it. Some kids hate it.
Yeah. So I think two points. There's two points I really want to get through on this show. One is that learning with other people is a great way to learn. The more interaction you have, the more you're talking, the more you're learning, you're getting other people's ideas. The other part, which is kind of a surprise, but not really, is that you need to learn how to work with other people. And so I'm very bad at this. In a conversation, I can't figure out how to get into the conversation, right?
You're one of those awkward party goers.
Yes. I either interrupt them or I wait a little too long and the other speaker sort of slips into the parking slot before I have a chance to say my thing.
Right. And they're off on a different topic and you're Yeah. So I think I would agree with you. You have to learn how to work collaboratively. And I think we have adults who haven't learned this. right? So
why are you looking at me when you say that?
Okay, well, you're my boss. I can't criticize you like that. But no, I will say this. I think it would be great if everybody learned this in school, not just because it makes learning better and kids will like it and it seems like you get better ideas and all that, but because we will have a better society because people have learned how to collaborate.
So this was one of the original impetuses for looking at collaborative learning. It came after World War II, and people wanted to figure out how to get people to interact even when their goals are conflicting, so they could negotiate even though they were different. And this was sort of, how can you get people to collaborate even though they have different goals? You know, so that it doesn't escalate. And this is a big thing to learn. It's of great importance.
Well, we are really lucky because we have one of the world experts.
We do. We have Rachel Lotan with us, professor at the School of Education. And she is the author of Designing Group Work, which is now in its third edition. And Rachel, as you know, I would have sold my mother to have a book in its third edition. So welcome.
Did you just say you would have sold your mother? That's crazy, Dan. Okay.
Like I said, I'm not very good at the group social thing.
I think that's coming through. Rachel, thank you for joining us. I have to say, from a lot of parents out there listening, there's a lot of people who think group work, boy, that's like the blind leading the blind. How can you put kids together and expect good outcomes and fair outcomes? So why don't you tell us a little bit about group work and why we should like it if we're a parent or a student?
Well, thank you for having me. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Denise. I'm really glad you're not my boss anymore since I retired, Dan. But I enjoyed co-teaching with you. both of you raised a whole bunch of really nice points about why kids should work together and learn together. And also, Denise, I think that many of the complaints and challenges that both parents and kids talk about when they engage in group work are very legitimate. Because in my opinion, nothing is worse than group work badly done.
Aha.
And unfortunately, I have to admit that there is a lot of group work badly done.
So what's an example of some?
The one that Denise mentioned about having, for my case, it was my daughter who came home one day and said to me, "Mom, I know group work is your livelihood, but let me tell you, it sucks because I end up doing all the work."
Yeah.
My son enjoyed it greatly because he was the social loafer and he had everybody do the work and then, you know, get the good stuff. So I think that a lot of the complaints are and a lot of the challenges are totally legitimate, particularly the one that you just mentioned, Denise, which is the blind leading the blind, which I have not seen that much in the classroom, because if the task that the problem that the kids are to solve and the problem is such that many different perspectives can come into it, there's always someone who can contribute something interesting, something worthwhile. And kids are really interested in each other's ideas. I found that across grade levels and even in graduate school.
So I agree with this. It seems to me there's like two parts here. One is people need to learn how to take turns or have roles in the group. The other is you need like a group-worthy task. So philosophers, when they write papers, there's only one author. In other fields like psychology, there's usually five authors. In astronomy, they have a limit that you're only allowed to have 100 authors on a paper. So there must be something about these tasks that sort of pull for their ideal for individuals or groups or large groups.
Yes.
So what are there features that I should look for a group-worthy task?
Well, one of the most important features is that a group-worthy task should be open-ended. And I was talking to a group of teachers one time, and the teacher asked me, "So Rachel, what's an open-ended task?"
Yeah. Right.
And my answer came to me kind of in a flash. And I said, well, an open-ended task is where the answer is it depends. And it depends on the conditions that you have, and it depends on what it is that you want to achieve, and it depends on what your perspective is. And how do you combine the perspectives of everybody in the group? And I really valued your comment, Dan, about the importance of group work and people being in contact with each other to get to know each other better. And therefore to, in many ways, combine our different perspectives and have a better society.
So a couple of points there. But just so if I am working on addition problems where there's a single answer, group work's not ideal for this because?
2 + 2 = 4?
Yes.
Okay,
but it's
so
not.
It's not in somewhere between 3.9 and 4.1.
The answer isn't. It depends when you have 2 + 2.
Or the problem is that if there's one known answer and one kid knows it, everybody will have that kid do it. So there's no way for everybody to participate.
Both. I mean, both of your points are very valid. So in that case, you know, I know that Denise is good at math, and I'm just gonna tell her, Denise, just give me the answer.
Right.
Okay, let's not debate about this.
And there's peer pressure to do that because I'm too scared or shy or whatever to say, Rachel, I'm not supposed to give you the answer. We're supposed to be working on it together. And what just happens is I just give you the answer. That's not good, right? That's group work gone bad.
Right. And unfortunately, that's a lot what I see. And because really constructing and drafting and designing, you know, what I call a group worthy task, takes time and imagination and creativity and really expanding the curriculum. You can't have true group work.
I'm going to make one exception to this. Okay. So it's not sort of. This is kind of group work where there's a group of students working together on a problem. Another kind of group work that's very effective is peer teaching, where one student is teaching another student. Mm-hmm. And it turns out the student who's doing the teaching, even if they really know the content, they learn even more.
Yes.
That seems like it would work for sort of closed tasks.
It works for a lot of things. It works when you say, yes, closed task, and, you know, kids do a lot of spelling with the flashcards you know. And it works also when someone has to explain something to some other kid or a group of kids.
I'm going to tell our listeners out there that they are listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are here talking with Rachel Lotan about group work, having a fascinating conversation about what is group work gone bad versus really good group work, which it sounds like it's very challenging to do. Rachel, can you just give an example? One of the things that you've said is everybody should have a role. So what would be an example where everybody has a role with sort of an open-ended, complex task in a group work? What are some of the roles?
So the roles are important to manage the groups. And what's so interesting is that I have seen kids in second grade, even first grade, perform their roles really well. And I'm going to tell you why we need roles. Because when you have a classroom of 30 kids, or in some of the high schools these days, 40, and you want to put them in a group, and you have anywhere between 8 or 10 groups, the teacher cannot kind of supervise all the groups at the same time, right? Go from group to group and supervise them all. So at some point, the teachers need to rely on the students and make sure that they are indeed on task and engaged. And so different roles that take over the responsibility of what the teacher would do are delegated to the kids. And that works really well.
So there's
someone, some people call the facilitator, some classes called it the captain. I like captain less, but
I like captain.
Oh my gosh, Dan is going to start making us call him captain now. You realize that?
Yes, which gives him status and stuff like that, which is why I don't like it.
What is the facilitator? Let's stick with facilitator.
So the facilitator's role is to make sure that everybody understands the task. Because in my experience, a lot of disengagement from kids comes because they just don't know what they're supposed to do.
So if they're not participating in the group, it doesn't mean that they're dumb. It doesn't mean that they're in a bad mood or they're actively revolting against it. Maybe they just don't understand the
directions. They just don't understand, right. And, well, this is another point, and I'll come back to the roles afterwards, Denise, but the other point is that sometimes kids don't participate because the group won't let them participate, because the group never listens to them, because they are the invisible one in the group. And you said the shy person before, right? And I think that that's a kind of a not very good excuse for that. You know, when the teacher says, Rosie never participates because she's shy. Well, I see Rosie out in the playground, and she's not behaving like a shy person at all.
Right.
Okay. But when she's perceived as not very smart or not very popular, then she can't participate.
So is the facilitator supposed to get everybody participating?
So the facilitator makes sure that everybody participates. Then there might also be a moderator, which is another kind of a role, who makes sure that there is feedback to the group and, you know, looks out for kind of the social emotional stuff. There is someone who will take the notes for what the group discusses. There is someone who is the materials managers and goes and brings if they need the glue and the colors and the markers and the paper and the magnets and the circuit, goes and brings it from wherever they are, right? So that the classroom is organized. Because when group work doesn't work, it's chaotic, and that's not good.
Well, I think that's why a lot of teachers.
Yes.
That's one of the reasons why the teachers get so worried.
Yes.
Right? I don't have everybody with their eyes on me.
Yes.
I know this one's going to go off, and this one's going to talk to his neighbor, and I don't have control. Yeah. You're putting a lot of faith in the kids.
Yes.
When I taught,
you have to trust them. Yes.
When I taught, and it got out of control, the single best thing to do would be to say, test, and everybody suddenly is looking straight at their desk, and I've got control again. You have these groups, and it's chaos. You don't know what they're all saying. You don't know what they're doing. So, yeah, it's scary if you don't set it up well.
And you've got to hope that those roles are working, and the moderator and the facilitator know.
And the reporter and the resource person.
So, fascinating conversation, Rachel. You are listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're on the campus of Stanford University and on Sirius XM Insight 121.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back. You are listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we are talking with Rachel Lotan about group work.
So I have a question. The things we've been talking about are sort of how do you orchestrate the group roles? What are kinds of tasks that are particularly for groups? But this is not the number one question I get from teachers about group work. So Denise, can you guess what the number one question is from teachers?
I would say sort of how do I grade it?
How do you grade it?
Right. Like how do I give everybody a grade as an individual when they're working as a group? That would be one of the questions that I would
ask. Okay, so Rachel has to answer that one.
Okay.
What do you think is the number one question?
Grading is big. Both from parents.
I just want to point out, Rachel agrees with me, so I think that counts as being stumped.
Then I'm not going to tell you. I'm not going to tell you.
Wait. But Dan asked, "What do I think is the most important question?"
No. I asked, "What is the number one question that you get asked, or that I get asked? Because it's all about me. What's the number one question I get asked?" The answer is, "How big should the group be?"
Ah, okay, that's a fair question. So, Rachel, you get two questions that you got to cover here.
Okay, so let's take the easier one,
yeah.
Which is that when we're talking about group work or small group work in classrooms, it could be anywhere between 3 and 5. There's no research that I know of. It seems that 4 is the ideal number because, you know, nobody is kind of left out if people pair up. But it can go up to 5. 6, I think, is too big because you should have eye contact with the people in a group. You should be able to have eye contact.
I like that.
That's very good.
And avoid the situation then that you were talking about. How do you get into a conversation when there are too many people? And 3 is sometimes too few because really in a truly group worthy task, you need so many different intellectual abilities and capacities and, you know.
To have a truly diverse perspective.
Yes. Okay. And contributions to make.
Okay, now the question that you think so important.
This is so important.
And then can I say what I think is the most important later on?
Yes.
Say it now. I can't wait.
So for me, and we'll get back to grading. I know, Denise, you want to talk about that. But for me, the most important question is how are we going to get equal participation? How are we going to make so that not one person dominates the group, Dan?
Right.
And not one person says, oh, I'm too shy and I can't talk and nobody will listen to me, Denise. Right.
Or, in my kid's point, how does Allison not have to do all the work in the group?
So that because actually the level of participation is related to the outcomes, that has been shown over and over again.
What does that mean, Rachel?
That kids learn more when they participate.
Okay.
And that has been demonstrated over and over again. So for me, that's one of the most important points.
That's good.
Yeah. Irrespective of gender and ethnic and, you know, and accent and size.
When everyone participates, everyone learns more.
That's right.
Okay.
So grading, my advice to teachers is to avoid grading a group product to give a common grade, which is an average or whatever teachers invent for what the group achieved.
I think people are saying yay out there in listening land.
Yes.
I think parents and kids would love that idea.
Yes.
So how can
I get it across to
So 30
people?
Years ago, the proposal was you choose one of the kids in the group at random and you give that kid a test and everybody in the group will get that grade.
And it seemed like that is so unfair. That's crazy.
Well, wait. But it was also that the group had to take responsibility for making sure that everybody knows the answer.
So that when you chose
that
random kid.
Yes. And I actually have a piece of tape where the kid said, you know she's going to ask him.
You are listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are having a lively conversation with Rachel Lotan about group work and in particular right now, how we're grading group work.
Yeah.
So if we're not going to pull a kid at random and ask them and test them and assess them from the group, what is the best
way? Can I just point out that it turned out that if you randomly pick, it did improve learning, but it was so hateful that no teachers or students wanted to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it felt unfair.
It feels
unfair.
Totally unfair.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Also, like, you're picking on it. And what that one kid, it's sort of like the kicker in the football game, you know? You've got, it's like, there's 30 seconds to go. And if you miss, you know, God forbid, that's it.
Yeah.
That sounds terrible.
Yeah.
So what's a better way to do it?
So I think that a much better way to do it is after kids have had an opportunity to teach each other, to learn from one another, to collaborate, to solve the problem, they will have to fill out an individual report. And they can talk about the report. That's not a problem. Later on, when there is a quote-unquote test, then they're totally by themselves, for example. But there is a lot of what we call building up, the scaffolding, the building up of preparing each other and taking responsibility for each other. So you do have to assess the individual learning outcomes. Nothing wrong with that. And you'll find that after group work, those outcomes are higher than when there isn't group work.
Well, I think people are very happy to hear that. I will say another little trick that I've heard, and actually my kids told me about this, that seems to be a good thing, is using technology, for instance, Google Docs or whatnot. You can see who did the work and you can see when they did it. And that gives the teachers a little bit more perspective. I like the idea that everyone's still being individually assessed, but there's a little bit more sense of fairness that a teacher can come in and say, hey, you haven't really done anything until the night before. You know, the teacher would see that. It seems a little bit fairer to the kids. They feel there's a little bit of equity okay. there.
One last question. So I'm a parent. My kid needs to cooperate. They're having trouble. They ask me, as a parent, Mommy, what can I do to cooperate better? And I say to them, there's no I in team. Is there anything better that I, as a parent, might do to help to get my kids prepared for this?
I in team. What does that even mean?
You don't know this?
No. It's a famous saying. Yes. There's an I
being I self. Pronoun yes. I.
But the kid was asking for serious help yes. here.
So number one, you model teamwork and you model cooperation. That's one of the best things. And you don't take it for granted that kids know how to do it. Nobody's born that way. And so there are all kinds of what we call skill builders to build a skill to cooperate. And you see the benefits of that.
So do you believe that there's a way to teach people to cooperate in school so that when they go to the workplace and cooperation's there, nobody's setting it up perfectly for them. We can get them so they're able to cooperate out in the business world and things like that.
We sure hope so.
We hope so.
This is why Rachel does what she does. This is why we want more teachers to teach kids to collaborate and more kids to buy in and understand that there are ways to make it fair and equitable. And teachers to understand that kids really like being with their peers and working together, and that, you know, more eyes and ears come up with better solutions. So, Rachel,
and they learn more.
Thank you so much for being a wonderful guest. We so appreciate you being here today.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Denise.
So, Dan,
it was a pleasure.
What are the takeaways from this?
Well, I think it's where we started, which is collaborating is a great way to learn. Interacting, social, but you got to learn how to do it. And it doesn't just happen by magic. And sometimes, you know, collaboration, there's friction and you got to learn how to deal with that in groups. And if you never get a chance to do it, you're not going to be able to do it, which means you're not going to get the benefits for learning when you do collaborate.
And I think most people realize that most of the real world tasks out there in the job are not done individually. You don't just sit and do a worksheet in your office. You're working with other people. You have to learn how to collaborate and do that work together. So you're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're on the campus of Stanford University and on Sirius XM Insight 121.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.